They said first it was just about Afghanistan. Once they solve that one, there's going to be no more need for violence. Before you knew it, there's Iraq. Before you know it, it'll be Syria, Iran. Before you know it, it could be Kashmir and the South Asia.
Syrians from the lowest to the highest love America, and they look toward us because we're the people that have the Declaration of Independence.
In my opinion, it's not a constitutionally elected government, and it's a government that's been taken over by a small handful of people who have lied and manipulated the truth to suit their purposes.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, April 15th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A U.S.-sponsored forum that brought Iraqi opposition leaders together to shape the country's post-war government began today with a U.S. promise not to rule Iraq and concluded with an agreement to meet again in 10 days. Meeting in the biblical birthplace of the prophet Abraham, delegates from Iraq's many factions discussed the role of religion in the future government and ways to rebuild the country. But some Shiite Muslim groups boycotted the meeting and thousands protested nearby. Secretary of State Colin Powell, seeking to tone down hawkish rhetoric towards Syria, said today the Bush administration has expressed concerns about Syrian actions but has no plan for a military move against the Damascus government. In an appearance at the Foreign Press Center, Powell said Iraq was, quote, a unique case, unquote, that required U.S. military action. He rejected the suggestion that the administration has a list of countries against whom it might also retaliate militarily. Powell said there is no list, there is no war plan. And he acknowledged that the administration has informed both Syria and Iran that their actions during the Iraq war were not helpful. He specifically cited reports from Syria that has given sanctuary to Iraqis wanted for human rights crimes. The administration had accused Syria of sponsoring terrorism and harboring remnants of Saddam Hussein's Iraqi regime and told Damascus to stop it or face diplomatic or economic sanctions. Yesterday, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice warned Syria, quote, it is time to sign on to a different kind of Middle East, unquote. Syrian officials denied having chemical weapons and said the United States has yet to prove similar charges against Iraq. They also accused Israel of spreading misinformation about Syria. Scott C. Davis is the author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. The book is a travel log in which Davis shifts back and forth between the Syrian police state of Hafez al-Assad and the rich cultural heritage underneath this little-understood Arab country. In this informal commentary, Davis shares with Peace Watch his perspective on Syria and the events as they unfold.
All of these accusations by the administration are questions on the order of, when did you stop beating your wife? They're intended to rile Americans and to put Syria in a bad light, but they're not really informative questions or questions that are, you know, based on a real picture of the country. You know, the first point to keep in mind is that, you know, Syrians love American culture. They love American ideals. The U.S. government had a hip-hop group that, from Chicago, I believe, that was a Muslim hip-hop group. When they came to Damascus, it almost caused a riot. The people were mobbed. Syrians are the first to ask the State Department to send American cultural exhibits and cultural exchanges on tour. And the fact is that Syrians from the lowest to the highest love America, and they look toward us because we're the people that have the Declaration of Independence. We're the people with the Bill of Rights. We're the people with the Fourth Amendment. And they depend upon us to hold those ideals high. When Syrians are angry with us, they're angry with us because they feel we are betraying the high ideals that are embedded in our most precious documents. The government of Syria is the same way. You know, the quote-unquote dictator who is running Syria happens to be a fellow who's educated in London, who made an inaugural speech in July of 2000 before Parliament in Damascus that could have been written by Thomas Jefferson. The guy is a reformer. He wants civil liberties. He wants freedom of speech. He's released half the political prisoners and is in favor of releasing the rest. He's opening the economy. You know, what would we ask somebody to do that he's not already attempting to do? So I think it's pretty arrogant of the United States to think that here's a country that we can demonize at will. I think that the public needs to think of the word disinformation when they hear these very, very loose phrases like harboring terrorists coming from the administration. Syria, after 1967 defeat to Israel and after the 1973 war, which could also be described as a defeat, found itself with a population that was enraged. They said, the Israelis are doing terrible things to the Palestinians. Our government is incapable of opposing them with our army, so we're going to take matters into our own hands. And people began training in camps around Damascus. They began arming themselves, and the idea was that they wanted to infiltrate Israel and commit guerrilla acts on their own to carry the battle on. So the Syrian government clamped down on this, and instead, through support behind the Hezbollah, and before that, by giving office space to different Palestinian groups like the PFLP-GC, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. So when the U.S. says Syria is harboring terrorists, they're talking about administrative offices for groups like the PFLP-GC. They're talking about Syrian philosophical support or maybe a little bit of logistical support for the Hezbollah. But what they're really not saying is that both of these things are examples of the way that the Syrian government has actually prevented terrorism and prevented freelance guerrilla activity from threatening Israel. So far as the motive for the current smear campaign, it's got to be pretty obvious that the exact same kind of language preceded the attack on Iraq. So I'm not sure the administration wants to attack Syria. I think they want to demonize Syria, put Syria in a position where Syria feels that it's vulnerable to attack, and then extract whatever concessions suit the administration. So given that Syria's government has power from the poor and the formerly disenfranchised who now have education and positions in government and positions in the economy and in business, many of the policies, for example, the economic policies of the regime, are to keep the price of bread cheap. And so they've sacrificed growth that they could have had and other kinds of economic benefits in order to create a stable life for Syria's families. And probably one of the finest things about this country is the beautiful families, communities, and neighborhoods, and I guess you'd say extended family life that Syrians enjoy, with a very, very low rate of crime, to the point of saying that crime is pretty much non-existent by American standards. So it may be just a little bit of a conspiracy theory to say, what happens when the United States goes into Iraq, takes the suggestion, which was recently voiced in public, actually, by representatives of Israel, that the oil coming to Syria from Iraq should be cut off, and taking that and implementing it. Also, is it really an accident that the Syrian Ministry of Trade in Baghdad that was organizing trade between the two countries was destroyed? Is it really an accident that the oil pipeline between Syria and Iraq was destroyed? If the Syrian economy can be dismembered by severing its trade relations with Iraq, its largest trading partner, then we have a situation where Syrians are going to be hungry, the economy is going to be poor. In order to revitalize the economy, the regime might have to raise the price of bread. Maybe there are riots in the streets. Maybe the regime has to suppress those riots and start looking like an ugly dictatorship. And then the United States would have evidence on the ground to support its charge that Syria the Syrian government is not particularly supported by its people. Okay, that would be a motive to invade or to crush Syria even more in diplomatic and economic terms. So I think, or at least I fear, what we're seeing is an American attempt to destabilize Syria. And the problem is they have carte blanche to do this because Americans know almost nothing about Syria.
An informal commentary from Scott C. Davis, author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. U.S. military engineers have reported that they shut down a pipeline used for oil shipments from Iraq to Syria, shipments Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld calls illegal. But Rumsfeld said he could not guarantee that the pipeline was completely shut off or that oil was not being clandestinely shipped from Iraq to Syria. "We do not have perfect knowledge," Rumsfeld said at a Pentagon news conference. "We do know that they were instructed to shut it down, and they have told us that they have." Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said coalition forces had not destroyed any pipelines. The Bush administration is hoping to put a friendly face on its military occupation of post-invasion Iraq in the form of CIA proxy Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress. Chalabi's U.S.-assisted reentry into Iraq was accompanied by 700 of his personal militia. But there are more potential leaders for Iraq, including the Iranian-based Ayatollah al-Hakim, who commands 20 times more troops than Chalabi. In an interview with Sharan Harper and Robert Knight on Pacifica Station WBAI, Brooklyn College professor Stuart Shar, co-author with Marvin Gettleman of the New Middle East and Islamic World Reader, discussed the Iranian connection in Iraq, as well as the lingering connection between Iraq and Syria by way of the Ba'ath Party.
The Ba'ath Party originated in Syria with two gentlemen who were bypassed by events. Michel Aflaq was the major architect of the ideology. And it really is a nationalist pan-Arab ideology with social welfare components. They claim it's Arab socialism, but it's missing many consistent aspects of what we know of as socialism, but certainly social welfare components for the population. The problem that the ideology faced almost immediately was that if a given ideology is pan-Arab, meaning that the ideologues want unity of the Arab world, the question was posed immediately, how do you do it? How do you achieve it? And given the fact that the imperial legacy was that of nation states, it really fell to nation states or one nation state to create that unity, which immediately led to conflicts between Syria and Iraq. And when you see it on the ground, it becomes very significant. They're competing with each other everywhere. Everywhere I go in the Middle East and North Africa, over the years, I found small Ba'ath parties that were financed by Syria or by Iraq, and there were also Libyan parties as well, so that it was very difficult to construct a political system in most Arab countries without expecting interference from outside. And not from communism and not from the United States within this framework, although that happened as well, but more so from Ba'ath elements who were trying to establish stronger tendencies towards unity within the countries that they were working in. The party tends to be highly centralized, and therefore it leads towards dictatorial regimes almost by definition.
The word Ba'ath.
Resurrection, or renaissance, if you will.
All right. And the diplomatic relationship between the Arab culture of Iraq and the Aryan culture of Iran and the Ottoman culture of Turkey.
The entire area, except for Iran, of course, was under Ottoman control since the early 16th century. The Ottoman Empire was over by 1923. The legacy of the Ottomans within Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, the rest of North Africa, except for Morocco, was extremely important. And you see it in remnants of some food that you could watch today, and it really means something. The most important legacy was that the Arabs were used to having a state over them. I'll give you one example. The moment the Ottomans conquered a territory, within a year, they knew how much each piece of land in the territory conquered was worth. And they had a bureaucratic administration that was able to collect taxes, or they had tax farmers in a decentralized system that made sure that the state got its revenue. That means that there was a strong state there, decentralized or centralized, depending on when. And therefore, the people of the Middle East have been used to state structures over them with a great deal of autonomy as long as they paid their taxes. The Iranian tradition is quite different from the Ottoman tradition. In the early 16th century, the Shiites took over Iran, which was then a Sunni country. The Shiites are a minority of Muslims. And what they did was kick out all of the Sunni religious scholars. And they imported Shiite religious scholars from southern Iraq and from Lebanon. And they became the intellectual elite of Iran. So there's a tradition of ties between Iraq and Iran and Lebanon among the Shiite population and Iran that's very, very significant, that continues to this day. The important item for today in Iraq is that the Ayatollah al-Hakim, who is a Shiite leader living in Iran, who has had 26 relatives of his either killed or disappeared as a result of the Ba'ath regime in Iraq, is a national hero among Shiites in Iraq. The Americans claim to be petrified about his coming back because he has an army of 15,000 troops that are stationed in Iran waiting to return. The recent killing of an important mullah, a religious figure, outside the Mosque of Ali, the holiest place in Shiite Islam. This man was the son of a leading Ayatollah who died years ago. And the followers in the mosque owe their loyalty to Ayatollah al-Hakim. So the struggle already is taking place between American and British-backed religious scholars and religious leaders and the Ayatollah al-Hakim and his followers, who really have the upper hand among the Shiite community, as far as I could see, from this distance.
Stuart Shar is the co-author of The Middle East and Islamic World Reader. He spoke today with Pacifica Station WBAI's Wake Up Call.
When you can't believe a word they say, and you're haunted by the swords they raise, like a rabid dog we've seen before, they refuse to hear the world pounding down their door. We don't want your war. Let's all yell a little louder now. We don't want your war. All stand together tall. We don't want your war. You keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. The king has no clothes, so he leads by fear. We must challenge all the lies we hear. The devil's bombs has an oily smell, frames a legacy with infamy. He burns it into hell. We don't want your war.
We don't want your war. U.S. troops are scouring the bomb site of the Al-Mansour district of Baghdad, a residential neighborhood where bombs were dropped after word came that Saddam Hussein was there with his sons. Speculation abounds around whether the U.S. possesses Hussein's DNA, which is necessary for a forensic identification of remains found at the site. So far, no one knows whether Hussein is dead or alive. Renowned author and Middle East scholar Edward Said has a rather unique perspective of what may have happened to Hussein and shared his opinion today on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
I think the main thing is that, you know, the United States reserves for itself the right to do anything it wants, basically. That's the message. There is no international order to contain or sanction it in any way. And it's set a precedent now for a lawless action of this kind in the years to come, both by itself and by others. I think the only hope lies with the U.S. With the U.S. citizenry that can put some brakes on the behavior of this government, which is a minority government. In my opinion, it's not a constitutionally elected government, and it's a government that's been taken over by a small handful of people who have lied and manipulated the truth to suit their purposes. And their purposes are, it now appears to me, to use the Middle East as a tabula rasa, to rewrite the history of the Middle East, and to erect a new order that will not give it trouble, they think. They give the United States trouble for the years to come. The actual war in Iraq was as one suspected. It was a very short war. I think, I don't have any information, but the sequence of dates suggests that when the war started to go badly in the beginning, in Basra and the South generally, a deal was struck, hence the sudden disappearance of Saddam Hussein and, more important, his army. Mr. Seale said, the convoy with the Russian ambassador was hit on the 6th, I think it was, of April. On the 7th, Condoleezza Rice appeared in Moscow. And on the 9th, Baghdad fell with no resistance to speak of. My hunch is that he gave up being the survivor that he is, and was allowed to leave the country under Russian auspices, in return for which the United States would have a free hand to do whatever it wants, to get its quick war, to declare triumph, and so on and so forth. So now I think what's going to transpire is perhaps more transparent and less difficult to manipulate, which is this attempt to create a democracy by sponsoring meetings here and there, by carding Ahmed Chalabi and his boys around and bringing in other people. I mean, it'll be a horrendous mess, while U.S. corporations like Halliburton and the other will begin to move in for the spoils. I mean, the total reconstruction of Iraq is going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars, and there we are.
And what makes you believe this, that the U.S. struck a deal with Russia?
I find it difficult to believe that the army just completely disappeared along with Saddam Hussein and his people. And Condoleezza Rice's appearances in Moscow, following quick upon that, and, the collapse of the Iraqi army and indeed of the Iraqi regime. It was obviously due to the fact that the Iraqi regime had very little to sustain it. This is not, wildly exaggerated reports of its great power and fear and all the rest of it circulated, you'll recall, before the other Gulf War, the 1991 war, the fourth largest army in the world, et cetera, et cetera. The war was over in 3 days. So I think there was a slight chance that this could go on longer, especially if they got into house-to-house fighting and Baghdad became kind of Beirut in the last stages of the Lebanese civil war. I mean, all kinds of things could happen, and there was no way of putting a limit on it in quite as easily as they had suspected. So that's the surmise. I mean, it's a kind of Mycroft Holmes, armchair at home kind of speculation. But I doubt that he'll be found anytime soon. And, the remnants of the regime are probably scattered around in different places in Russia and elsewhere. That's my guess. I don't have any information. But the dates are beguiling.
Do you have any thoughts on the firing on the Russian convoy
that
made
that
its way to Syria with the Russian ambassador to Iraq?
I mean, I think that was part of it. to remind them that they were there. That's, as I say, it's a kind of slightly crazy interpretation. But it's difficult to explain the total and sudden collapse of the regime, of the army. I mean, there was literally no fighting to speak of in Baghdad. And this was an army that had, and a resistance that had shown, you know, quite a bit of spunk in the south. And the numbers of American troops brought into Baghdad were really not big. I mean, certainly not big enough for a city that's, you know, 5 million, has 5 million inhabitants in it. I think the whole thing suggests a political deal of some sort. And the quick turning of attention now to Syria suggests also let's not focus too closely on Iraq, because what's there is pretty inchoate and likely to lead to further anarchy of one sort or another. I mean, they can sustain a military occupation, an orderly one, for a short while, but Iraq is too large a country, physically large, and there isn't enough. The Iraqi opposition that's been brought in from the outside has, as far as I can tell, hardly a constituency inside the country. That leaves, you know, the usual suspects, which the United States has always favored. The balance of the Shia clerics and the Sunni minority and some of the Kurds and so on and so forth to try to keep things going. But there's no clear plan as to what's to be done.
As a distinguished man of letters and a kind of minister of culture yourself, I wanted to ask you about the plundering of the National Museum in Baghdad. Also today, we hear about the burning to the ground of the National Archives of Baghdad. In both cases, a pleading with the U.S. military to protect these areas. But it appears one of the only places they protected in Baghdad was the Ministry of Oil.
Well, you said it yourself. I mean, that's a priority. Don't forget that this is an army dealing with a relatively new army of volunteers, mostly drawn from the very most disadvantaged minorities and classes of the country, with no experience. I mean, if you asked most of them a month ago where Iraq is or what Iraq was, or Iraq, as some of them call it, they wouldn't have a very clear idea. They have no idea what kind of civilization they're dealing with. I mean, most educated people in this country don't either. So, I mean, there's that. As somebody said, you know, Iraq is a vast archaeological site. The whole country is just a palimpsest of civilizations and whatnot. Already, of course, plowed up and bombed during the 1991 war. Now again, and, you know, so that what could happen and what might have happened, we're not prepared for. I myself was horrified and shocked at the looting and the pillaging and the destruction of the museum, because for whatever you thought of Saddam Hussein's regime, which is pretty awful, the work on the museum and the antiquities of Iraq has continued, and it's the effort of the last 200 years. It's not, you know, it began under the Ottomans and continued under the British and so on. So it's obviously the whole situation comes from, you know, a mad orgy of sort of destructive fury directed at everyone around, sudden removal of restraints, and the obvious conclusion drawn, I think, by the population that engaged in this horrible act, that the U.S. wasn't interested. You have to, you know, do anything you want kind of thing. As you say, the important issue is the oil. One should ask oneself whether, if Iraq had been the world's largest exporter of oranges, whether this war would have taken place in the first place, no matter how awful its regime was.
Renowned author and Middle East scholar Edward Said speaking this morning on Democracy Now! With host Amy Goodman. On a lighter note, a piece of political satire produced by the Christmas Comedy Coup players of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
And we now go to CCNN, Christmas Coup Network News. This just in, Basra in southern Iraq has been captured by the coalition forces for the third time this week. Saddam Hussein International Airport has been taken by American Liberation Forces. The future military dictator of Iraq, General Tommy Franks, has renamed the airport Halliburton International Airport. Liberated Iraqi people continue to show their appreciation for the American Liberation Forces by firing small arms, grenades, and driving suicide car bombs into checkpoints. The weather in Iraq today is hot and sandy, and now we have the latest traffic report from Iraq. There's a 30-mile delay at the Hussein Midtown Tunnel. Use your Liberated Easy Pass to avoid delay. The Osama bin Laden Parkway is backed up for 2 miles with a Humvee hitting an overhead pass. The Jihad Highway from Syria is slow, with hundreds of suicide car bombers coming in. One of the cars has a flat and will have to wait till they blow up that tire. The upper deck of the Sheikh Rahman Bridge is your best bet to get into the city. An M1 Bradley tank has collided with a Liberated missile and is causing a backup on the Mujahideen Expressway. The Iranian Turnpike is backed up all the way to the northern no-drive zone. The HOV lanes are now working into the city, so if you have two or more soldiers in your vehicle, you will save 20 minutes. Transit is working close to schedule, depending on electricities and bombing. Just remember, you give CCNN 2 minutes, and we'll give you the body count.
That was the Christmas Comedy Coup Players. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.